Welcome to a deep dive. Today, we're plunging into one of humanity's most fascinating and maybe most fundamental questions. What is reality?
Yeah, it's a big one.
It really is. And it's not just some abstract philosophical riddle, is it? It's a puzzle that's captivated thinkers, you know, from ancient Greece right up to cutting-edge quantum physicists.
Absolutely. It touches everything. How you see a color, the nature of the universe itself.
It's this deep sort of human desire to really get what's fundamentally real.
But here's the kicker, right? The very act of trying to understand it often just shows us how limited our knowledge actually is.
Or how our own minds shape what we think we know.
Exactly. It's really an ongoing inquiry, you know, not some problem you can just solve.
Yeah.
Which makes it endlessly compelling, I think.
Totally agree. And to help you navigate this incredibly complex landscape without, hopefully, feeling too overwhelmed, we've pulled together a fascinating stack of sources.
We've got cosmology, quantum physics, philosophy, psychology, even science fiction.
And we're going to try and extract the most important nuggets, kind of give you a shortcut to being, well, truly well-informed on what reality might actually mean.
Yeah, our mission today is basically to deconstruct existence itself.
Yeah.
We'll look at its objective side, the subjective part, and the inner subjective dimension, too.
And what's really cool, I think, is how science fiction fits in.
Oh, absolutely. It acts as this amazing thought experiment laboratory, doesn't it? Exploring hypothetical realities, what they mean for us.
While at the same time, self-reflection gives you that personal pathway to understanding how your mind is constructing reality, like right now.
Every single moment.
So what does this all mean for you listening in? Well, you're about to uncover some genuinely surprising facts, I hope, and gain a whole new perspective on everything you thought you knew.
From the tiniest subatomic particle to the grandest cosmic scales.
And right down into your own inner world. Okay, let's maybe start at the beginning with some philosophical foundations. Because when you talk about reality, it's not just one thing, is it?
Not at all. Philosophers have sort of broken it down into different, let's say, flavors.
Right. So first up, objective reality. This is the stuff that exists independently of any mind's perceptions, biases.
Like the classic 2 + 2 = 4. Doesn't matter who's counting.
Or a meteor hitting a car, even if nobody sees it happen. It still happened, objectively.
Exactly. And scientific realism basically says the world described by science exists in this objective way.
Then distinct from that, we have subjective reality.
Which is entirely personal. Depends completely on your individual mind.
So this includes your biases, your perceptions, emotions, opinions.
And those really private, qualitative experiences, qualia, philosophers call them. Like the specific taste of your favorite cake.
Or how you perceive beauty, right? That's purely subjective.
Totally. Or think about the weather. It might feel pleasantly warm to you.
But boiling hot to me.
And both are subjectively true for each person. You can't really truly describe your experience of red to someone else, can you?
No, you can't. That's a crucial distinction. And bridging that gap, then, is intersubjective reality.
Right. This isn't just, like, shared opinions. It's the shared experiences, understandings, expectations among people that let us function together.
It's key to what gets called social constructionism, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where things get their meaning from the social and linguistic rules within a culture. Mm-hmm. We need a kind of perceptual consensus.
A collective agreement.
Yeah, for us to have a shared understanding of things, like what a dollar bill actually is. It's just paper. Objectively, but intersubjectively, it has value.
Or what marriage means within a certain culture.
Exactly. And this leads us to a really fascinating paradox about human perception.
Go on.
Well, objective reality is supposed to be mind independent, right? But your subjective mind can only ever process it through its own unique filters.
Ah, right. So what we often call objective truth
is frequently more like a collective subjectivity or that perceptual consensus we just mentioned.
Wow. Think about that for a moment. If even what we call objective truth is often a shared agreement, how does that change things?
It really makes you question how you view, well, everything. News, cultural norms. It suggests reality isn't just out there waiting to be found.
It's constantly being built and rebuilt among us.
And this consensus, it's not always democratic either. It's often been historically kind of aristocratic.
Influenced by intellectual heavyweights like Aristotle or Galileo.
And underlying power dynamics, definitely. Which raises big questions about biases and how accepted facts change over time.
It really makes you wonder, doesn't it, how much of what we accept as solid fact is actually, well, maybe not so solid after all.
Precisely.
So, okay, we've got these different flavors of reality. Let's take a quick trip through history. How did philosophers wrestle with this? Platonic idealism, for instance.
Right, Plato, he thought true reality wasn't here in our messy physical world.
No, it was in these higher, eternal, abstract forms or ideas, independent of our minds.
And the physical world we see, just an imperfect reflection, like shadows on a cave wall.
Then, in a pretty stark contrast, you had George Berkeley with empirical idealism.
Famously saying, to be is to be perceived. Things only exist as they are perceived.
He didn't believe in external matter.
Nope. Only an infinite being, God, essentially kept things existing while we weren't looking.
Wild. Okay, then Immanuel Kant came along with transcendental idealism.
Kant argued that basically our knowledge is completely based on mental structures. Your mind actively shapes your experience.
So you can only know phenomena appearances as processed by your mind.
But not noumena, not things in themselves as they exist independently. We can't access that directly.
Which brings us to a really radical idea, solipsism.
The idea that only one's own mind is sure to exist, it's pretty out there.
And there are different shades of it.
Yeah. Metaphysical solipsism says only your mind is real. Everything else is just a representation within it. Epistemological solipsism is a bit softer. Say the existence of an external world is just an unresolvable question. We can't know for sure.
And the third type.
Methodological solipsism. It's more of an agnostic approach. It says, look, any justification for an external world has to start from the undeniable facts of your own consciousness.
Like Descartes, I think, therefore I exist.
Exactly. That's the starting point. But here's the practical problem with the stronger forms.
Right. How would society even function?
Critics argue that if you truly believed it, daily actions like voting, paying taxes, or planting a harvest would just seem like products of your imagination.
You couldn't really operate.
Pretty much. A functional society kind of has to implicitly reject metaphysical solipsism. You know, for social cohesion and moral action, we have to act as if others are real.
That's quite a thought, isn't it? Our shared reality is built on a collective agreement not to be solipsists.
In a way, yes.
Okay, let's turn inward now. Let's talk about the mind's eye, perception itself. It's not passive, is it? We don't just soak things up like a sponge.
Not at all. Perception is an active, dynamic process, almost a dynamic conflict, as one source put it, between the outer world and your brain's effort to make sense of it from your perspective.
So information comes in through the senses.
But then your brain gets to work
Yeah.
processing it. And it's influenced by everything your past experiences, what you expect to see, cognitive biases, the context.
It's like building something, not just receiving it.
Exactly. It's a multi-stage construction project. You have the raw stimuli, the determinables
Okay.
hitting your receptors. They become perceptibles as they're electrically altered by your nervous system. Then, crucially, they pass through what some call a cultural matrix.
A cultural filter.
Yeah, schemas, learned meanings, values.
Yeah.
Your culture shapes how you interpret things. Only then do they become percepts, what you actually consciously apprehend.
So it's biocultural perceptual determinism, shaped by biology and culture.
Right. And it's even more complicated because psychological stuff gets involved, neuroses, anxieties, memories, they all color perception.
And perceptual illusions, like seeing a mirage.
Vividly show you can perceive things that aren't really there or are totally distorted. Your brain is filling in blanks, making assumptions.
So, what about perceptual realism then? If perception is so constructive.
Well, you have different takes. Naive direct realism is the common sense view. An object keeps all its properties, like yellowness, even when unseen.
Seems straightforward.
But scientific direct realism is more nuanced. It distinguishes between primary qualities like shape, size, mass, which are independent of you,
Objective properties.
and secondary qualities like color, smell, taste, which depend on your perceptual system. The yellowness isn't in the banana itself, it's how your brain interprets light reflecting off it.
It really drives home that the objective world you interact with is always, always a transformed version, mediated by biology, psychology, culture.
Exactly. True, unmediated objective reality, fundamentally inaccessible to us. What we call objective is, in practice, this highly refined, culturally validated, intersubjective agreement.
And crucially, you said this cultural matrix isn't fixed.
No, it evolves. As cultures change, beliefs change, science advances, the frameworks we use to perceive and interpret the world change too.
Meaning reality, at least the reality we experience.
Is continuously being co-constructed and deconstructed. It's like we're constantly updating the operating system of our shared reality. Fascinating stuff.
Okay, so we've explored how our minds construct reality, but let's zoom way out. What about reality on the grandest scale? Does it stop with our universe, or could reality itself branch out?
Ah, the multiverse. Yeah, this is where cosmology gets really wild. One huge idea is cosmic inflation.
The rapid expansion right after the Big Bang.
Exceedingly quick, yeah, for maybe just fractions of a second. And the theory suggests this might be the universe's natural state.
Okay.
During its crazy expansion, quantum fluctuations, tiny jiggles, caused different regions to expand at slightly different rates.
And this created?
Separate, self-contained bubble universes, each potentially with its own unique laws of physics. Imagine infinite bubbles forming in boiling water.
Wow. And eternal inflation.
That's the idea, that this inflation never completely stops everywhere. Some regions settle down, like our universe, but others keep inflating indefinitely, constantly spawning new bubbles.
An infinite number of universes.
Potentially, yes. And there's actually very good evidence for inflation itself, from how galaxies are spread out and from the cosmic microwave background radiation, the Big Bang's afterglow.
So this isn't just pure speculation.
The underlying inflation part is well supported. The eternal inflation and bubbles are more theoretical extensions, but they profoundly challenge this idea that our universe is unique and perfectly fine-tuned for life.
How so?
It offers a statistical solution. If there's an infinite multiverse where every possibility happens, then a universe like ours, suitable for life, isn't some miracle.
Yeah.
It becomes statistically inevitable somewhere.
It just had to happen in one of the bubbles.
Exactly. It removes the need for a special explanation for our existence in a way.
That's a lot to take in. Okay, another mind-bending idea from physics. String theory.
Right, a candidate for the theory of everything. Instead of point-like particles, it says the fundamental constituents are tiny, vibrating, one-dimensional strings.
And the vibrations determine particle properties,
yeah.
Like different notes on a violin string.
That's the analogy, yeah. But a huge implication is that the theory doesn't just describe one universe. It describes an enormous landscape of possible universes.
How enormous!
The estimates are staggering. Something like 10 to the power of 500 possible solutions or universes.
10 with 500 zeros. I can't even picture that.
Nobody can, really. But some physicists see this vast number as a virtue.
How?
It again offers an anthropic explanation for our universe's specific properties, like the very small value of the cosmological constant, which drives cosmic acceleration. Why is it this precise value?
Because if it were different, we wouldn't be here to ask.
That's the anthropic idea. In a landscape of 10,500 universes, of course we find ourselves in one where the constants allow stars, planets, and observers to form.
But critics must have issues with this.
Oh, definitely. They argue this vast number makes precise predictions difficult, maybe impossible. If your theory predicts everything, does it really predict anything?
Raises questions about falsifiability, right? Can you even test it?
Exactly. And relying on the anthropic principle feels like an excuse for failure to some physicists. If the theory can't make unique, testable predictions, is it really science?
Okay, shifting from the cosmic scale down to the quantum. Quantum mechanics and the many worlds interpretation, MWI.
Quantum mechanics is famously weird. One key weirdness is the observer effect.
The idea that just looking at something changes it.
Sort of. The act of measuring a quantum system inevitably alters its state. Before measurement, a particle might be in a superposition, like potentially in multiple places at once. Measurement forces it to choose.
But does it need a conscious observer?
That's a common misconception. Most physicists agree observation just means interaction with a measuring device or the environment. Decoherence theory explains how interaction causes the superposition to collapse into a definite state.
As Richard Feynman put it, nature does not know what you are looking at.
Precisely. It's about physical interaction. But the many worlds interpretation, proposed by Hugh Everett, offers a radical alternative to collapse.
What's the idea?
MWI says the wave function, the mathematical description of all possibilities, is objectively real and never collapses. Instead, every possible outcome of a quantum measurement actually happens.
How? Where?
In different parallel, non-interacting worlds or branches of reality, every quantum choice point splits the universe. Time becomes a many-branch tree.
So Schrodinger's cat is both dead and alive.
In MWI, yes. There's a branch where it's alive and another branch where it's dead. Both are equally real. It aims to resolve these quantum paradoxes by just accepting all possibilities as physically real.
And some think these many worlds might be the same as the bubble universes from inflation.
Some physicists explore that connection, yeah.
Hmm.
maybe different levels of a multiverse.
But the criticism is the same as with string theory, isn't it? Falsifiability.
Exactly. MWI is heavily criticized for being unfalsifiable. If these parallel universes don't interact with ours, how can we ever prove they exist?
You'd need to put something big, like a cat, into superposition and somehow interact with both branches.
Which is way beyond anything we can do experimentally. So this leads to these broader scientific debates. Are multiverse theories really science? Or are they speculation or philosophy?
Occam's razor often comes up, the simplest explanation is best. Critics say postulating infinite universes isn't simple.
But defenders flip it. They say maybe explaining our specific universe as just one part of a larger, simpler multiverse is the more elegant explanation, avoiding the need for fine-tuning. It's a philosophical debate as much as a scientific one.
And the anthropic arguments are debated too.
Hugely. How do you define life? How do you calculate probabilities across infinite universes? It gets very tricky.
Plus the causal disconnection. If they can't affect us, how can we scientifically verify them?
Right. True multiverse theories posit universes that are completely disjoint. Nothing crosses over, which for many scientists puts them beyond any scientific support.
It really highlights the inherent limits of science.
Definitely. Science has provisional limits, things we don't know yet. It might have external limits, things potentially beyond its scope, like maybe ethics or beauty or the divine.
And internal limits.
Limits discovered by science itself. Quantum indeterminacy means some things are inherently probabilistic. Mathematical theorem shows some truths are unprovable within a system. Science cannot offer a complete explanation of all reality.
So this whole frontier is pushing science to maybe redefine verification, rely more on theory, consistency, explanatory power, not just direct proof.
It certainly seems to be blurring those lines between theoretical physics and philosophy. We're asking questions that might not have empirical answers, at least not yet.
Okay, let's really turn inward now. We've talked about the mind shaping reality, but is reality all in your head? This brings us to the hard problem of consciousness.
Ah, yes, David Chalmers' term. This isn't about the easy problems. How the brain processes information, controls behavior, reports mental states.
Things science is actually making progress on.
Right. The hard problem is, how does physical stuff, like neurons firing, give rise to subjective experience? The what it is like quality. What it feels like to see red or feel pain or be you right now.
Why isn't it all just dark inside? Why is there subjective awareness at all?
Exactly. It's a profound mystery. Philosophical approaches range from physicalism, consciousness is just brain activity somehow,
to non-physicalism, consciousness is something else, not reducible to the physical.
And then you have idealism, which offers a really distinct take. It proposes that reality itself is fundamentally mental mind, spirit, consciousness, or at least entirely a mental construct.
Different flavors here, too.
Yeah. Ontological idealism. All reality is mental. Epistemological idealism. We can only know reality through ideas, through the mind. Some versions posit a cosmic idealism, grounding reality in a universal mind or deity.
And there's a contemporary version making waves.
Analytic idealism, particularly championed by Dr. Bernardo Kostrup. He argues persuasively that consciousness is fundamental, not something that emerges from matter.
So it flips the whole thing. Matter emerges from consciousness, not the other way around.
That's the core idea. What you perceive as physical reality might actually be a manifestation, like ripples on the surface of an underlying universal consciousness.
Whoa, that completely changes the cause and effect picture we usually have?
It does. And proponents argue that positioning consciousness as fundamental offers really elegant solutions to some deep quantum paradoxes.
Like the measurement problem.
Yes. If consciousness interacts with the quantum realm, maybe measurement is consciousness collapsing the wave function. And quantum non-locality particles instantly linked across space makes more sense if consciousness transcends space-time. Even Wigner's friend paradox becomes less paradoxical.
That's genuinely mind-bending. Okay, moving from universal consciousness to your personal experience. Self-reflection, introspection.
The foundation of self-awareness.
Right.
It's crucial for growth, healing, examining your values, beliefs, experiences to understand who you are.
And even the idea of the self isn't straightforward.
Not at all. You have essentialism, the idea of an inherent, unchanging core self, like Plato thought.
Versus nominalism, like David Hume's bundle theory, where the self is just a collection of changeable experiences and attributes. No fixed core.
And your personal reality is just inherently subjective, isn't it? Shaped by your unique life, beliefs, emotions, how your brain works. Your brain actively constructs narratives to keep things consistent.
sometimes distorting things in the process.
Absolutely. And this is where practices like mindfulness become so powerful. They train you to just notice your internal state, how it's influenced, how it affects you, without judgment.
Connecting with reality as it is, rather than the story you're telling yourself about it.
Exactly. It sharpens perception, increases well-being, helps you regulate behavior. You become more aware of the construction process.
And beyond just immediate awareness, there's existential reflection.
Using reflection to grapple with the big questions. Identity, mortality, values, finding meaning in life. It's a deeper dive.
You mentioned the looking glass self earlier.
Yeah, the idea that your self-concept is partly built by imagining how others see you. Identity as a co-creation.
And in the digital age, this gets amplified with our cyber selves.
Totally. Our LinkedIn profile, Twitter persona, highly curated, malleable versions of self. It really deconstructs the idea of a single fixed personal reality.
So mindfulness helps cut through those narratives.
It can help you escape the self-imposed mental narratives.
You know? Yeah.
Connect with a more direct, less distorted perception. Move beyond automatic reactions to clearer understanding.
Okay, so if reality is this fluid, subjective, maybe branching thing, where do we find purpose? Where does meaning come from? Let's dive into that.
A huge area. Existentialism is a major player here. Its core idea. Existence precedes essence.
Meaning you're born first, then you figure out who you are and what your purpose is.
Exactly. You're not born with a pre-given purpose, like a tool designed for a job. You're just contingently thrown into existence. You have to create yourself through choices and actions.
Which sounds freeing, but also kind of terrifying.
That's the anxiety of choice. Freedom is empowering, but it's also a burden because there's no guaranteed meaning, no cosmic safety net.
So existentialists emphasize authenticity.
Right. Living authentically means breaking with just blindly following tradition, courageously affirming your freedom, and committing to self-chosen projects that give your life meaning.
And different philosophers had different takes. Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, Sartre.
Yeah, Kierkegaard linked meaning to faith, Nietzsche to the will to power and reevaluating values. Sartre emphasized radical freedom and choice in a meaningless universe. Camus focused on embracing the absurd, but moving forward anyway.
The common thread seems to be that meaning is created, not discovered.
That's the profound liberation of it. Yeah. Mm. It shifts the focus from finding the meaning of life, the ongoing personal act of making meaning, building your own purpose.
Now, in stark contrast, we have nihilism, which sounds pretty bleak.
It can, yeah. Nihilism essentially rejects core aspects of existence. It believes life is ultimately meaningless, moral values are baseless, maybe knowledge itself is impossible, the ideology of nothing.
Different types here, too.
Existential nihilism is the one most people think of. Life has no inherent meaning or purpose. Achievements are ultimately pointless, often linked to awareness of mortality.
Leads to indifference, existential crises.
Can do. Then there's moral nihilism, denying any objective basis for morality, good and evil, are just human constructs. Hmm. Nietzsche described nihilism generally as the highest values devaluate themselves.
So it's the ultimate deconstruction of meaning, stripping away all inherent value.
Pretty much, but paradoxically.
There's always a paradox.
Right. For some, confronting this absence of objective meaning actually prompts the creation of subjective values. Like, if nothing inherently matters, then I get to decide what matters to me. It can be a catalyst for self-creation, ironically.
Interesting. Okay, what about spiritual perspectives? They offer a very different map.
Often radically different. Many spiritual traditions view physical reality as maybe a dream or a cosmic illusion, a temporary state.
Where the soul is just a witness.
Something like that.
Yeah.
The focus is often on detachment from the material world because it's seen as less real or less important than a deeper spiritual reality.
And many traditions also posit consciousness as fundamental.
Yes. Often with a divine being or ultimate reality conceived as pure consciousness, creating individual consciousnesses to experience itself. This implies a profound interconnectedness.
Which contrasts sharply with strict materialism.
Which says, no, soul, God, that's all just human thought, products of the brain. Dualism tries to find a middle ground, mind and matter, both real, contributing to reality.
And specific traditions, like the Christian perspective.
Views reality as deeply influenced by God, extending beyond the tangible to a spiritual realm, angels, demons, afterlife. Scripture is divine truth. Faith experiences are transformative. Humans are physical and spiritual. The soul is eternal.
So these perspectives fundamentally deconstruct the perceived solidity of the physical world.
They really do. They redefine reality as something deeper, often spiritual. And meaning comes not from the external world, but from internal transformation, spiritual connection, understanding your place in that deeper reality.
So, okay, reality is complex, maybe multi-layered, maybe branching, maybe fundamentally mental, maybe spiritually grounded. How do we even begin to explore these possibilities?
Well, this is where science fiction becomes so incredibly valuable. It's like the ultimate reality lab.
Exploring multiverses and alternate realities is a classic SF trope.
Absolutely. Think of Everything Everywhere All at Once. That movie brilliantly uses verse jumping.
By doing weird random actions.
To tap into skills from alternate versions of the main character. But beyond the wild sci-fi, it's deeply rooted in real themes. Immigrant families, mother-daughter relationships, existential angst.
Or Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. A physicist gets abducted into an alternate life he could have lived.
Yeah, exploring this labyrinth of realities, forcing him and the reader to confront identity, choice, the road not taken. SF multiverses act as this existential mirror.
It makes you think about the alternate versions of yourself, right?
Exactly. It suggests identity isn't fixed, but fluid across possible lives. A powerful deconstruction.
And SF doesn't just play with alternate universes. It deconstructs consciousness and identity itself.
Oh, constantly. Remember the film Altered States?
Sensory deprivation tanks, psychedelic drugs.
Leading to biological devolution, transforming into this primordial mass of conscious matter. It asks, are our other states of consciousness just as real as our waking state?
And Altered Carbon takes it even further with technology.
Those cortical stacks recording consciousness, allowing immortality by switching bodies or sleeves.
It totally detaches identity from the physical body.
And explores huge questions about selfhood, memory, gender identity when bodies are interchangeable, social class based on who can afford better sleeves.
Then you have things like Blade Runner with its replicants, or Ex Machina with its advanced AI.
Beings that are virtually indistinguishable from humans with subjective experiences, emotions. They force you to ask, what actually defines human? What is identity if it can be engineered or coded? What are the ethics of creating consciousness?
SF really pushes the boundaries, doesn't it? Deconstructing traditional ideas of self, making us reevaluate consciousness, personhood, existence itself.
And perhaps the most famous SF reality bender, simulated realities.
The Matrix has to be the prime example.
Absolutely. A sophisticated simulation mistaken for reality. It just slams you with the question, what is real? How reliable are your senses?
And it draws directly on classic philosophy.
Totally. Plato's cave allegory, prisoners mistaking shadows for reality.
Yeah.
Descartes' evil demon deceiving us. The brain in a vat thought experiment. Robert Nozick's experience machine, would you plug into a perfect simulation?
The Matrix isn't just action, it's applied philosophy. Challenging how we get knowledge, if we can trust our senses.
And it's a critique of modern society too, right? Technological dependence, media manipulation, consumerism as its own kind of simulation.
It's a powerful update of ancient questions using technology as the deceiver, which really resonates today with VR, AI, deepfakes.
It prompts that critical examination of the structures around us and the basis of our own knowledge and freedom.
So really, science fiction is way more than just entertainment.
Oh, much more. It's an intellectual laboratory. It takes complex ideas, extrapolates trends, comments on the present, issues warnings, inspires.
It shapes public perception of the future of technology.
Reflects social issues too, like prejudice and identity in something like X-Men. And its track record for inspiring actual tech is amazing.
Handheld communicators inspiring smartphones.
VR, self-driving cars, bionic limbs, genetic engineering, 3D printing, augmented reality, gesture interfaces. The list goes on. SF writers imagine it, then engineers try to build it.
But it also serves as a critique, a warning.
Definitely. It explores the dangers, the downsides, the imperfections. It concretizes these huge philosophical questions we've been talking about, addresses the big issues confronting humanity.
Gives us new perspectives.
It really is a kind of prophetic genre. It both reflects our reality and actively helps shape it, influencing technology, ethics, social norms, blurring that line between imagination and what might actually come next.
So after all that, multiverse, mind, meaning, sci-fi, what does it all mean for you listening? Where does this deep dive leave us?
Well, I think the clearest takeaway is that reality isn't some single, solid, fixed thing.
No, it's much more like this incredibly complex, evolving tapestry.
Woven from, you know, the objective frontiers of science, but also your own deeply subjective experiences, and those intersubjective agreements and understandings we build together.
Yeah. Scientific theories like eternal inflation or the string landscape challenge our idea of a unique universe, suggesting this vast sea of possibilities.
But they also force us to confront the limits of what science can actually prove empirically. There's still so much mystery.
And at the same time, the profound role of your mind in constructing your personal reality, highlighted by the hard problem, by the way perception works, by self-reflection, shows that even what we call objective is filtered, mediated, and built through shared understanding.
Exactly. And within that complex interplay, meaning itself isn't just handed down.
It's dynamic, often self-authored. Whether you're embracing that existential freedom to create your own purpose,
or finding your own way after confronting nihilism, or seeking something transcendent through spiritual paths, it's an active process.
And what's truly fascinating, I think, is how science fiction weaves through all of this.
It really does act as that crucial laboratory, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Exploring multiverses, simulations, fluid identity, providing these thought experiments that mirror our deepest questions and anxiety.
And actually shaping our future in the process, blurring the lines between imagination and what could actually be.
Yeah.
So ultimately, this journey through multiverse, mind, and meaning, it isn't really about finding the single definitive answer to what is reality, is it?
No, I don't think so. It's more about continuously deconstructing and reconstructing your own understanding, being open to new perspectives.
It's acknowledging that reality is this multifaceted thing, maybe phenomenon is a better word, perpetually redefined by scientific discovery, philosophical inquiry, personal experience,
and the boundless human imagination. The quest absolutely continues for all of us.
So after today's deep dive, what aspect of reality are you most compelled to deconstruct next?